This audio file is number 3 of 3 available at www.shun.net/inclination. The recording that follows is excerpted from episode number 45 of William Shun's Shuncast, a podcast freely available at shun.net/podcast, or through the podcast directory of the iTunes Music Store. Inclination, a novella by William Shun. First published in Asimov's Science Fiction, April-May 2006. Part 3. The sensation of walking spinward inside a great turning wheel like Netherview Station is a little like walking up an endless inclined plane. Because your feet are borne forward by the rotation a tiny bit faster than your head, you might feel, if you're attentive enough, as if you're leaning slightly backward, or walking up the slightest of slopes. By the same token, a counter-spinward stroll might feel a bit like a walk downhill. But compare your slight forward angle to a tangent of the circle your feet are touching, and you'll see that the attitude of your body is more like that of a person walking uphill. Thus, walk either direction inside the rim of a rolling wheel, and you partake of one aspect or another of ascending an incline. I haven't found much scriptural support for my position, and the members of Wheel and Axle in particular would call it blasphemy, but at some crossroads, it strikes me that any path you follow can lead you upward, and closer to the Builder. I sleep badly, unaccustomed to the richness of the food in my belly. Upon rising, I prepare Thomas what seems a meager and bland breakfast, all the while fearing that he will somehow sense that the chest and its contents have been disturbed. But he eats with all his attention on his manual, and he barely bats an eye when I tell him I may end up working overtime today. I arrive early at the hub, in time to catch Rennie in her spherical office well before the start of our 2-day shift. "I want to learn more about this vacuum hardening procedure," I tell her without preamble. "How can I do that?" Rennie vaults out of her chair like a charged particle expelled from an atom. "If you weren't crippled, you could ask from anywhere," she says, clinging to the frame of the hatch and shoving her ugly face into mine. "As it is, you'll have to use a Jeff room. There's one not far from here." She leads me on a brisk walk. "You know," I say as I hurry to keep up with her, "my father's pretty upset with you." Rennie looks over her shoulder and grins. "What, for telling you about the job? Oh, I heard from him. Nothing he could do about it, though. It's regs, and Thomas knows it. Like he has room to complain the way he called in so many favors to get a barefooter like you onto the team in the first place. But he's your father, and he's just following the script, same as me." She stops before a row of 3 hatches, each emblazoned with the old-fashioned schematic symbol for an activated light fixture. I've passed hatches like these at many times since starting my job, but never known what they were. Rennie rears up on her hind arms and pats the gleaming surface of the first hatch. "Now here's the next part of my script," she says. "This is a Jeff room, where Jeff can tell you anything you care to ask about. He'll answer all your questions, and then some. The light bulb is glowing, which means the room's unoccupied and you can walk right in. Take all the time you need, but if you're going to be here longer than the first hour of shift, have the big lug message me so I know." She touches a panel in the center of the hatch, and it opens with a slight hiss. "Keep your eyes and ears open, kid," she says, and I step inside. "Don't be afraid," I won't bite. The voice is a warm tenor and originates from no location I can see in this small, very white room. The ceiling is high enough to let me stand comfortably. My outstretched arms would nearly span the room in both dimensions. A body-enfolding chair, like you might find at the medics, rests at the center of the deck. Panicked, I turn, to find the hatch has sealed noiselessly behind me. I can barely see its outline. "Have a seat, Jude," the voice says. "We've got a lot to talk about." The air is warm, but my skin prickles cold and hard. "Where are you?" I say. "How do you know my name?" "I've known you since you were born, Jude. I'm glad we're finally getting a chance to talk. This happens so rarely with members of your guild. But we'll talk more comfortably if you sit. Please." "Blasphemy," my mind cries. "False gods!" But I ease myself down into the chair, letting the cushions take hold of me. I feel the chair adjust to my size, and carefully I lay my head back in the niche that fits it. A man appears before me, a pot-bellied man with flowing white hair and a bushy white mustache, dressed in a billowy white coverall, a man carrying a wooden carpenter's square. "Sela," he says. I start in alarm, but the man makes calming motions as he bends over me. "The builder," I gasp. He shakes his head. "If you see me in the likeness of the builder, it's only because that's your strongest conception of a figure of benevolent wisdom. Not to aggrandize myself at all." He looks down at the carpenter's square in his hand. This probably doesn't help matters. He tosses the square over his shoulder, and it vanishes. "Who are you?" I say, struggling to sit up. The man crackles and flashes transparent. "This'll be less disorienting if you stay down in the chair," he says, "for both of us." Suspiciously, I lie back, and the image solidifies. In fact, I can feel the man as he presses a comforting hand to my chest and pushes me down. "I'm Jeff," he says. "No last name, but I can give you a version number if you're really interested." He smells faintly of sweat, smoke, and some kind of musky perfume. "I don't know what you mean," I say. "I know," he says with a smirk. He pulls up a chair from nowhere, seats himself near my knees, and crosses his legs. "But you came here because you wanted to ask me something. So go ahead, ask me anything you like. Ask me as much as you like. That's what I'm here for." "What are you?" I ask. "A very sophisticated information retrieval system. Once upon a time, you might have called me a search engine, but I'm much more than that. I'm something of a diagnostician as well, and a physician, and a surgeon, and a teacher, and a tutor. A diplomat, a translator, an ombudsman, a legal advisor, and an advocate, too. And I play a mean hand of gin." "Where did you get the name Jeff?" "I'm thinking of Derek and his name change." "What does it mean?" Jeff strokes his mustache. "Nothing, really. I just liked the sound of it. It seemed to suit me somehow. Where did you get your name?" I blink. "From the manual." "Be glad you didn't end up Nebuchadnezzar." Maybe this is where Derek learned to be so cheeky. "How is it I can see you? It has something to do with the chair, doesn't it?" "It has plenty to do with the chair, and with its ability to create a microwave interface with your visual cortex. I can give you a more detailed technical specification if you like, but I imagine you have more pressing questions you'd like to ask." I'm delighted in spite of myself, and I raise my head out of the cradle several times in succession just to watch Jeff flicker in and out of existence. "Careful," he says, rising from his illusory chair. "You'll make yourself sick." He's right. My head has started pounding and the room whirls. My stomach feels none too steadfast in its grip on breakfast. I lie back and Jeff strokes my forehead. His cool fingers fail to disturb the swelling droplets of perspiration. I take deep breaths, digging my fingers into the padding of the armrests. "Tell me about this vacuum hardening process my boss keeps telling me about," I say, eyes squeezed shut. "How does it work?" "There's not a lot to it," Jeff says in a reassuring tone. What it does is construct around your lungs a sort of a cellular retaining wall that gets deployed on any catastrophic drop in air pressure. It actually seals shut your lungs and can temporarily prevent the gases in your bloodstream from expanding and killing you. This retaining wall is also capable of breaking oxygen atoms loose from the carbon dioxide your blood returns to your lungs, so you can effectively keep rebreathing the same old air. That's only temporary too, of course. It's like any filter. Eventually it's going to get choked with carbon and fail. But you can last an hour that way anyway. More than enough time for help to get to you. In most circumstances. It sounds so reasonable when Jeff says it. I'm looking at him again now, and he has returned to his seat. Is the procedure expensive? I ask, praying the answer will be yes. Not at all, Jeff says. And if you can demonstrate a need for it in the course of your job, the station covers it anyway. You do qualify, by the way. Are there side effects? You might feel a little short of breath after the procedure, a little dizzy and weak, but your lungs will adjust within a day or so. That's all, really. I take a deep breath. And the procedure itself? It sounds complicated. How long does it take? Oh, about 20 minutes, Jeff says, tilting his head to one side. 20 minutes? That's all? You'd have the entire shift off, though, for recovery and observation. With pay. But how is that possible? I'm groping for words. I mean, it's sculpting, right? You can't just snap your fingers and it's done. That would be true, Jude, if we were starting from scratch. We're not. Now I can't breathe, and my insides seem to freeze. What do you mean? Jeff stands up and clasps his hands behind his back. You are what you call sculpted, Jude, as is every other member of the Machinist Guild on Netherview Station. You've been that way since before birth. The nanodocs passed on to you via your mother's bloodstream. Your nanodocs don't do anything more than maintain reasonably good health and let me keep tabs on you. But the potential is there for more. Much more. But why? Tears gather in the corners of my eyes. How can you do this to us? It's monstrous. Jeff looks pained. Jude, please understand what a fragile environment this station is. We have 2 million permanent residents and millions more who pass through every month. We can't have people running loose who aren't monitored in some way. But it's wrong. It's my body. Jude, if I weren't helping out, your body would have broken the first time you left the quarter. Your devotions keep your muscles strong, but the low gravity weakens your bones. You've had supplements in your food all your life to counteract the effects. I roll my head from side to side. Lies. I'm not lying, Jude. Not now, but all along. Everything we know, my people, it's all lies. I told you the first opportunity I had. Jude, you have the right to get this information at the age of 10, when you become a provisional citizen of Netherview Station. That's about 13 1/3 by your guild calendar. Unfortunately, the guild can keep that knowledge from you until age 15, 20 to you. You still have the right to ask and get answers, like you're doing now, but what good does that do most of you when you don't know you can ask? I'm shaking my head. I don't believe you. That would mean everyone knows. All the adults. My father. Everyone knows. Actually, no. Jeff purses his lips sadly and lays a hand on my arm. Just because they know they have the right to ask doesn't mean they'll actually do it. By the time they reach 20, most of them don't want to know. I don't want to know, I say, wrenching my arm through Jeff's hand to paw the water from my eyes. Why are you telling me this? Jude, no, you're the wrecker. I don't want to hear it. Jeff sighs. As far as I'm aware, I am not the wrecker. In fact, I'm not certain I'm capable of telling a lie. I try my very best to do good, really. Uncomfortably aware of how childish I'm being, I cross my arms and turn my head away from the preening phantom before me. I lie that way for some time, mind churning. When I look at Jeff again, he's watching me expectantly. I feel hollow inside. Jeff, I say, my voice small, can you fix my brain? Jeff leans forward, looking concerned. What's wrong with your brain, Jude?
I mean,
yes?
I think I'm out of true.
I'm almost whispering.
Bent.
How do you mean?
You know.
Pretend I don't. I lick my lips.
I think I like boys.
The admission leaves me feeling curiously flat, detached.
Can you fix me?
Jeff tugs at his white mustache. Jude, there are various therapy regimens I can initiate, but I don't fix things like sexual inclination. Not that I'd call you homosexual at all in the sense you'd think of it. The truth, I believe, is rather more interesting and complicated than that. My heart leaps.
What's the truth?
Your guild likes to treat sexuality and gender as binary values, either this or that. One right, one wrong, no other possibilities. But the ones you call sculpted understand these characteristics more as a spectrum of possible values, fluid and multidimensional. There's no either or, nor even necessarily a permanent identification with any given point on the grid. Jeff spreads his hands in an eerily builder-like gesture. Now, this is a preliminary diagnosis only, but you would appear to me to suffer from a multivalent somatocognitive dysphoria.
A what?
I ask, vague trepidation gnawing at my stomach. To put it more bluntly, your body is male, but the personality inside may be closer to the female end of the continuum. Not all the way there, of course, but more so than not. I shake my head despite the nausea I feel.
No, no, that's ridiculous.
You would have learned very early to hide the symptoms, the wants and behaviors your people wouldn't find acceptable in a little boy. But that, plus overcompensation in areas of archaically male pursuit, still wouldn't make them go away.
You're crazy.
The notion is offensive, repulsive. The builder doesn't make mistakes like that. In a perfect world, maybe not, Jeff says. But this world's anything but perfect, and we all have to come to our own accommodations with that fact. Now, I can recommend and even direct a course of therapeutic counseling, just as a starting point, and of course participation would be entirely up to...
No!
I shout. Stop it! Jude, let's at least talk about this for a...
You lying, false machine! Shut up! I can't think!
Jeff folds his hands in his lap as I turn my eyes to the white ceiling, chewing the inside of my cheek. I'm furious and terrified for my soul to realize how easily I've been taken in by the lies of this wrecker-spawned abomination. The right thing to do, the right degree of compromise, has never been more clear. I'm going to do it, I say. The steel in my voice a wall holding back utter dissolution.
I'm sorry,
do what? Jeff asks.
The vacuum hardening. I'm going to do it.
Are you sure? He sounds dubious.
Absolutely. But so you don't get any ideas, I'm doing it for the guild, not for myself.
I'm not certain what you mean by that.
The more hazard pay I get, I say, the more quickly my people can get off this godforsaken station.
Your pay is yours. It doesn't have to go to your guild.
I don't care.
It won't make any difference, Jeff says. The guild's debts are considerable.
I don't care.
Jude, I don't want you doing this under any false illusions. The guild owes so much money they can't even pay the interest on it. It's practically a losing proposition to keep housing them.
Then why don't you just let them leave?
I demand, enraged. Jeff shakes his head. I'll tell you if you really want to know. That's my function. But you won't like it.
I don't like it already. Just tell me.
As you wish.
I have to be concerned about the well-being of the station as a whole, and having you here serves a purpose other than economic. The existence of a permanent underprivileged social class reinforces in the minds of the rest of the population the benefits of full participation in this pseudo-socialist post-scarcity paradise of ours. Superiority breeds contentment, of a sort. So you're telling me my people live in poverty to provide an example of how undesirable poverty is? I told you you weren't going to like it. My anger has shrunk to a cold, clear gem in my heart. As if it took a supercomputer to figure that out. And I told you I'd made up my mind already. Well, he says, raising his eyebrows. He looks as if he's about to offer more argument, but evidently decides otherwise. So you give your consent for the vacuum hardening procedure? I give a curt nod. Yes. So be it, Jeff says quietly. He almost sounds chastened. I'll let your boss know you'll be occupied today, and we'll get started right away. I arrange myself stiffly in the chair, arms at my sides, as if waiting for the lid of my coffin to close. You're all right from here? Derek asks. We're standing at the PM gate, the smells and tumult and humidity around us as heavy as ever. His arm around my shoulder helps offset the crushing gravity. I nod a little woozily and say, it'll be easier inside. Quarter G. As the end of the procedure drew near, Jeff roused me to suggest I might want a friend to walk me home. I said Derek's name before I really thought it through. But even after the fact, wondering if that had been a good idea, it didn't seem to me I really had a better option. Jeff contacted him, and Derek was there waiting outside the Jeff room as soon as the hatch opened. Now he takes his arm from around me and watches with concern as I take a wobbly step on my own. Is this, you know, are you going to be in trouble? How will anyone know? I say. There's nothing visible that's changed. Derek looks like he's about to say something, then extends his hand instead. Green is now his predominant hue. Even his irises have changed color. Well, Jude, just in case, you've got a place to bunk down if you need it. No strings, just a place to stow your gear. I nod, my throat thickening. I try to say thank you, but I can't. I duck my eyes, pull the lever, and pass through the gate. I might be imagining it, but as the gate closes behind me, I almost think I hear Derek saying, "Sela, Jude." Inside, it's late and the corridors are empty. This is good because even in the lower grav, I'm having trouble walking a straight line. Jeff told me this is nothing to worry about, that I'll feel fine again by morning, but drawing the wrong kind of attention on the way home through the corridor would be something to worry about. The cabin is dark when I slip inside, and Thomas lies motionless in his bunk. I strip off my coverall as quietly and cautiously as possible, crank down my bunk, and slip beneath the blanket. I lie on my back, unable to relax or even close my eyes. I spent most of the day in essentially this position. Like Jeff promised, the process took only 20 minutes. Though, having felt nothing, I have only his word for that. But for the rest of my shift and beyond, I lay fitfully dozing as I recuperated. I suspect Jeff would have liked to keep me longer than he did, but my father would have been livid if I didn't come home all night. My heart pounds as I suddenly become aware that Thomas is sitting up. I try to fake deep, easy breathing as Thomas stands and pads across the narrow cabin. Even talking to him right now is too exhausting a thought to contemplate. Son, he says, almost a question, his voice subdued. I crack an eye. His face is a gray smear in the darkness, gazing down on me like the cinders of a burnt-out sun. Son, Jude. He sighs, breath hitching like an unbalanced motor. I've been thinking a lot, praying hard. I think it was wrong to send you to work. You can quit if you like. We'll get by. We'll manage. I'm not sure he knows I'm awake, sees my eyes wide and dilated in the dark. It's like he's talking to himself. But when he reaches down to stroke my hair, his face draws nearer and his brows knit. "Son," he says, his voice quavering. "Son, what have you... His hand snaps back like the magnetic arm of a relay switch. But I have only an instant to steel myself before he shakes off the stun and whips back, seizing me by my throat and one thigh and hauling me off the bunk. "What in the wheel have you done?" he cries, stumbling back as I watch the indistinct room tumble crazily around me. He loses his grip on my thigh, and my knees bounce off the deck even as my windpipe grinds against his other hand. I smash sideways against the bottom of the hatch, torn loose now from both his hands, and watch in the terrible clarity of low gravity as his leg swings back in an arc that will ultimately reverse and connect with my ribs. I've never felt revulsion before at his correctional touch, only the sort of accepting resignation born of an intimate belief in the justice of it. But now, sprawled on the deck, my skin crawls with a sense of wrongness and violation. Spasming, I curl myself around his leg at the moment of contact. I grab tight with both arms. I twist violently toward the hatch. Arms wheeling, Thomas hits the bulkhead face first. The lights brighten at his startled cry, and in the sudden glare, I scuttle desperately to the cabin's far corner. Thomas's face leaves a lurid red smear on the door as he slides to the deck. Dizzy, I push myself to my feet, lungs heaving, alternately holding back sobs and retches. Thomas huddles on the floor with his arms over his head. "Oh, Builder," he half coughs, half wails. "What did you do?" There's only one way he could have detected my mods. "You see it," I say, nodding like a drunk. "You're sculpted too, you hypocrite." He rolls over onto one side. "I couldn't do my job otherwise," he says, wiping blood from his mouth. "The job I have to do for you and our people. You have no idea what I've sacrificed." "If I have no idea," I shout, "it's because you never told me. You sent me out there to face the same choices, but you never told me what you chose." He sits up, wiping his face and examining the blood on his hand. "I told you what was right, Jude. That's my job. You think I can't figure that out for myself?" "Obviously not, just like your mother." He's breathing hard, wincing. "She couldn't make the distinction either, what one person sacrifices out of necessity and what that spares the rest of his family. She tore us apart because of it. She left this family in shambles." He pushes himself to his feet. "And I suppose you want to join her now, wreck or take you both." He totters the few steps toward me. I try to rise, intending to meet his assault on my feet, however it comes. When he lays hands on me, though, it's to take my elbow and help me rise. "Be my guest," he says, gesturing to the hatch. "The door's there." "The door?" I repeat, confused. "But I thought..." "Thought what? Thought..." Understanding dawns on his face like it hasn't yet on mine. "Oh, Jude." "What?" "You know so much else. I thought you must have found that out, too." I feel a tremble in my chest. "Found out what?" "About your mother. That she's..." Time seems to freeze. Something terrible roars somewhere far, far away. Someplace only I can hear it. "Son?" Something in my expression causes Thomas to release my elbow and take a step back. "Son," he says, hands up. "She was dead to us, dead in every way that mattered. She wasn't the same woman anymore. That woman died." I fling myself at him, fists pummeling his chest like I'm a 2-year-old throwing a tantrum. "I was only trying to protect you, Jude. She's a monster now. She's Wrecker spawn." "Liar," I cry, spittle flying from my mouth, tears blinding my eyes. "You liar!" Now he's crying too, behind his upthrust arms, but it can't be from my pathetic beating. I shove him away in disgust. He staggers and sits down hard on his bunk. Not pausing to think, I snatch my clothing from the netted basket beside my bunk and cross to the hatch. "And now you're leaving me too," Thomas says bitterly. "You're her son in every way." "Good," I say, turning the knob. "That's what I'd rather be anyway." I have one last glimpse of him, hunched on his bunk in the harsh light like a wild animal, clawing at his wet, puffy eyes, and the hatch snicks shut behind me. Standing over me, Kaya looks the same as she does in my half-waking imaginings. Tall, porcelain-skinned, with cascades of black hair, slightly larger than life, and no older than I remember. And those wings, those glorious, glowing white wings, stretching up into the inky night to touch at a point as far above her head as her head is above her feet. Each feather is as long and wide as one of my forearms. I could see her clasping me to her white-robed breast and soaring high out of the galactic plane with wings like that. She is an angel. "Jude, first let me tell you how sorry I am," she says, leaning in so close I can count every one of her eyelashes. "I must have made a dozen recordings like this for you, at least, every time I move or make some other change, but sorry is the one thing that's always constant. That and how much I love you." She's not here, of course, but I can almost smell the dry perfume of her hair, the oily tang of her wings. I'm in a Jeff room, the first one I could find, dressed and tipped back in the big chair and submerged in illusion. I can hardly believe this is happening, that this revelation has been so close to hand for so long, dormant and unguessed at. All I had to do was ask the right question, or rather, to learn there were questions to ask at all. The magic incantation which had summoned this genie forth from the bottle was, quite simply, "Where is my mother?" "I'm not authorized to answer that directly," Jeff told me, "but I do have a message for you." "I wanted to bring you with me. Really, I did, Jude. Not a day goes by that I don't wish I could. But because of the Guild's legal arrangements with the station, that was impossible. And after the change I'd made, I certainly couldn't stay. All I could do was hope that you reached a point, and preferably long before you reached your Guild majority, where you were able to start asking questions. Since you're seeing this, apparently you have. As I speak, you're now 10 years old, 13 by Guild reckoning. You're old enough to get this message if you ask, but not old enough that I can contact you directly. I don't know anything about you, what kind of young man you've turned into since the last time I saw you. Are you still as sweet as you were as a child, and as serious? What do you believe? What do you hope for? What do you dream? How have you changed? One thing's for certain, you must have changed some to be seeing this now. You must have made some hard choices, and you must have many more still to come. I'm still changing too, Jude. I'm heading into the final phase of my exomorphological transform. When you see this, I'll probably already be homesteading in the new bountiful colony at Van Manen's Star. It's a long way from here, terribly far. But that doesn't mean I won't drop it all to see you again. It won't be quick or simple, but if you want to start arranging it, just tell Jeff yes at the end of this recording, or any time afterward. A message will be dispatched to me immediately, though it may take a while to reach me. If you don't want to see me, she shrugs, and her mighty wings tremble. Well, you can just say nothing. I'll never know, and I can go on assuming you've never seen this. Is there really any question? Is there any doubt? Yes, Mom, I say, feeling my face crumple. Yes, 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 yes! I'm so proud of you, Jude, she says. You chose enlightenment over ignorance, and that's a terribly hard choice to make. I love you, and I always will, no matter what. I can't wait for you to see what I've become. And I especially can't wait to see what you've become. The manual tells us that in the beginning the builder decreed six fundamental machines. These are his six aspects, and all we do we must do with the six. We need no other machines. I believe this with all my heart. But not even my sincerest belief, I fear, is sufficient to make it true. Not when the shape of the builder's seventh great machine, transcending the other six, is coming clear. The seventh machine is me. Inclination, Part 3, copyright 2006 by William Shun, all rights reserved. This sound recording, copyright 2007 by William Shun, is made available under a Creative Commons 3.0 United States license, which permits redistribution only with proper attribution, unaltered, for non-commercial purposes. For more information, and for the other two parts in the series, please see www.shun.net/inclination. For more readings by William Shun, including the full text of the Mormon missionary memoir, The Accidental Terrorist, please visit shun.net/podcast and explore past episodes of William Shun's Shuncast. This recording has been a production of Sinister Regard.